Well, there he is. I don't think that works.
I think it's gonna be our new intro.
Is that white boy rap?
Come on, that's dance music.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it is.
Like a Saturday Night Live skit.
Yeah, it is. It.
All right.
What's your name? I'm Ryan.
Ryan. What?
This is gonna be a fun episode.
Yeah.
All right. You guys ready?
Yep.
Let's go. Dive in.
Look, I don't want to get this started on a bad note. I know we're talking about race, but you just said let's jive in on the race episode.
Dive in.
I thought you said jive.
I said dive.
He said jive.
He said jive, didn't he? He said jive. I swear you did. You got called out right there.
I didn't mean to.
It's all about where your heart and your mind's at.
Okay, all right. Well, let's jive in then. This is all going in the promo.
It should. It should.
All right, here we go in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Disruption Zone. Opportunity lives where the status quo dies. Talking to the greatest innovators, disruptors, and off-the-wall inventors we can scrounge up. You laugh, you'll learn, you'll be inspired. Now, here are your hosts, Leland Conway and Cameron Mills.
The Disruption Zone. I'm Leland Conway with Cameron Mills.
Hey, buddy.
And we're excited to be joined by a good friend of both of ours, 12, Mr. FTC, from Real 93.1, the Beat of Louisville.
A new friend of mine now. You got to do a full
interview. Y'all went way back.
No. Have we ever met before? I mean, we met in here once or twice.
Yeah, a couple of times.
Yeah, but we don't go back beyond these walls, do we?
Nah, we don't have the history of me and Leland doing those highway conversations.
Yeah.
Well, we've known each other for a few
years. That's what I'm saying. So I think for our listeners, you need to introduce him. I mean, you know, some proper introduction or let him do it.
Let's start with this. I think it'd be interesting for people to understand how you got your name. 12, Mr. FTC.
All right, it's two parts of my name.
Give us the lowdown on that.
All right, and the first part. You know, the 12 part is 12 letters in my government name, Matthew Brown. And me being in the world of entertainment, it doesn't sound cool to crack the mic and say, hey, it's Matthew. You know, it sounds more like I'm doing like hip-hop Bible study or something.
Hey, it's Bob Smith. Let's listen to some great music.
And Mr. FTC just means for the city.
Love it.
And if we would project it, you know, for other initiatives as it's for the children, faith through Christ, and other initiatives that I play off with the anonym.
Love that. I love it because you are... Not only are you a big media personality in the city of Louisville, but you're also a guy with a heart the size of Texas.
Look at his shirt.
Yeah, I know, right?
You look at his shirt, you know, this guy's giving some money to a children's hospital just to help some kids.
But here's the thing, though. Dude, I've seen you. You have this, like, really strong desire to see Louisville unify.
Yes.
And I love that's the base of your show name. Mr. FTC, for the city.
Correct.
Not for the east side or east end or west end, but for the city.
Well, everything should be positive. It should be solution-based. I mean, it's really easy to point the finger and say, this isn't working, that isn't working. I don't like what they're doing. I don't like what they're doing. So I like to bring positive content, and I like to bring solutions to the table.
How'd you get into radio?
I got into the radio. Actually, it's kind of a funny story. I have a history of music production. I was signed to a very large company.
On the ones and the twos?
Nah, not on the ones and twos.
Not on the ones and the twos? All
so right. I actually got to produce music through Universal Records for a huge label called Blackground. So I got to do some things with Aaliyah. Got to work with Timbaland and some other people over the years. And through that course, I didn't kind of like some of the things that were going on in the music industry. I know you hear a lot of rumors about the things that's going on. I'll let you know, a lot of them are very true. Mm-hmm. And I never went to any of those Manson parties, just so you know. So I never put on the ass-wise shut man. So don't ask, okay? But that led me into music engineering. And music engineering exposed me to a lot of people and also introduced me to the advertising world. And I absolutely love advertising. Mm. So I remember back in 2005, somebody asked me to actually voice a radio commercial. And ever since then, I never looked back. I got popular in the city because all the club promoters would come to me and ask me to do their radio spots.
Right.
That kind of pawned off and put me in a position to where I was offered a job in sales at 104.3, which is a radio station. It's not here anymore. That happened about 2010, 2011. And I parlayed that into becoming a personality. Mm-hmm. And I haven't looked back since.
It's didn't become a personality. You were a
person. Right. We just... The
you
city
were found.
The city just figured it out.
Yeah, I love that. The reason, like, part of why we wanted to have you on here, besides the fact that you're truly an interesting individual and a great person, but you and I have had several conversations in the hallways here at work. And our country, I think, in the last several months, especially, but in the last few years, has been experiencing tension, both politically, but I think also racially, in ways that I've never seen since, you know, as growing up, I just haven't seen us at Americans at each other's throats the way we have been.
Yeah, we only read about what's going on today.
Yeah, yeah. And now we see it. And I just thought it would be great because one of the things that, you know, Cameron and I are trying to do with the Disruption Zone is to talk to people from all different walks of life doing innovative and disruptive things within those walks of life and try to remind people that it's okay to talk to each other. To talk to each other when we're different from each other, to talk to each other when we hold different points of view,
yep.
And realize that there's a unity that comes out of those differences if we can just sit down and understand what another person walks through, how they view the world.
And I think a lot of it, too, is to understand that, okay, let's bring the race into it immediately. There are cultural differences between how you grew up and how I grew up.
Correct.
And one of the best parts about me, I mean, one of the biggest things I learned in playing basketball, not just at UK, but in high school, is probably 80% of my team was African American. I hung around those guys all the time. Those were my brothers. They lived differently than I lived. I don't mean just socioeconomically. I mean different culture. And all I did was ask questions. All I did was want to know. And it never offended anybody. They asked me, we live in a country that gets offended at the slightest thing when all we really want to know is we want an education. I want to know, what does this mean? Why do you do this? Why is this part of the black culture? Why is this part of the white culture? Those kind of dialogues we have to have, or we're going to do is be separated.
I think it's important to have that dialogue because nobody should be stuck with stereotypes.
Yeah.
You shouldn't be stuck with a frame of mind of what I saw on TV or what I heard from this song or that song. I'm going to put these people in this box. And you shouldn't have the fear to ask those questions.
Exactly.
You should want to know for yourself. So I appreciate people who have that attitude.
Do you think it's because I think back like nowadays, like we're talking about everybody being offended by everything.
Everything.
Comedians are having a hard time right now. You know, because I'm as a person who was born in the South.
I thought you were going to say as a person who likes to laugh.
No, I was born in the South. I have what you would call Southern roots. I grew up on an Indian reservation in Arizona. My parents are missionaries. I grew up in a culture completely different than the culture that I was born into. But I can remember watching comedians of all races making fun of people of all races.
Yeah.
Do you think that's actually a good thing for us to laugh at each other from time to time and laugh with each other about each other and our eccentricities to help blow away stereotypes?
And I was even going to add, is it okay to laugh at our stereotypes?
Absolutely. I think what it does is it breaks the racial ice. You
right,
know what I mean?
Right.
So, you know, and if you're laughing, if somebody makes a joke and says something about black people and it's actually true.
Yeah.
Not even going to laugh. I'm like, oh my God, that's so true. And I think we've all learned about different races through comedy.
Right.
Yeah.
And
yeah. How many times have you heard the joke, you know, the redneck joke?
The white
hey,
guy.
Hey, y'all watch this.
The white guy.
Because it's
joke.
True.
Listen, every time I watch an African American comedian do the white guy, I'm on the floor.
Yeah.
Because he's got it. That's us. That's us. I mean, you know, and the stereotypes of, yeah, okay. For the most part, again, I go back to athletics. My teammates, they were the more athletic. I mean, I am a slow white boy. I mean, that's true. Now, there might be a Rex Chapman here or there, but for the most part, I'm a step behind all my teammates. And I don't know what the reason is, but there's something there, and it makes us different. And being afraid of those differences, whether they're mental, emotional, spiritual, cultural, physical, that to me, that's what leads to the problems, is the fear of our differences. When what I hear is, we got to be celebrating our differences, and we should be, because we're not all that. We're the same in the basic ways. We're the same in the important ways, but we all live different lives, and we ought to be the same way, Leland. When you and I went down, what's the name of the reservation? I always botch it.
The Hano Autumn Nation.
That's why I always botch it. When I went down there, I met some people that I'm like are some of the sweetest, most incredible people. Just like every culture I go visit, you've got some amazing people. They live differently. They think differently. They are different. But they're also the same. And that should be celebrated and pushed to the top of what we talk about.
Well, let's think about the things that unite us all. First of all, every human being in life wants to be successful. Now, what success looks like is up to that individual. But we all want to be successful. We all want our families to thrive. And we all want our health. Those things all bind us together as human beings. None of those things separate us. One thing that I do as an African American or a person of color, because I have Native American blood in my roots as well, is that I have the mentality of the past can't be changed. History is history. Now, that doesn't give a pass on the things that happened before. You know, of course, historically, things have happened.
Right.
But I do not judge people based on what's happened before. I judge people based on the people that I meet and the interactions that I have. I don't carry that cross or carry that judgment everywhere I go. And as an African-American male and a person with Native American roots, I actually could walk around with a chip on my shoulder, right? I mean, I have every right to be angry. I have every right to be upset. I have every right to be hateful. But I choose not to cast it on other people. I don't think that that's fair.
Do you think, because I think on some level, and tell me if you think I'm wrong on this, we all could find reason to walk around with a chip on our shoulder. We've all been mistreated by somebody at some point. Now, sometimes it's been culturally mistreated. What we're obviously stating back to slavery, the Civil War, and all, you know, how African-Americans were treated and brought over from Africa in the first place. But we could all find reason to walk around with a chip on our shoulder and have a problem with everyone and basically play the victim or be mad at everybody because I didn't get a fair shake. But that never seems to help anything. And I think that's what you're saying is,
correct.
What does it do? When I can walk around and say, I'm going to judge you based on you, which to me is what Martin Luther King meant when he said, content of character, not color of skin.
Correct.
Right now, content of character. What do I like about this guy? What does this guy mean to me?
Yeah, and color shouldn't be the basis of everything. I remember when Barack Obama was going back for his second term, and I didn't agree with some of the policies he had his first term. And I don't want to steer off course and take this anywhere else. But when somebody asked, hey, man, you ready to vote? You ready to get Obama back in office? I said, well, let me do more of the research. And they were like, well, why are you doing that? You know, he's a brother just like you and me. I said, well, if I was to go through an inventory of my life and I was to list the 10 people in my life who hurt me the worst, who lied to me, who deceived me, who set me back professionally, who did anything, the people that look just like me. Mm. So I cannot make decisions just purely based on race. It has to be by the individual.
Mm. That's an interesting point because if we don't mingle with each other,
right.
If we don't become friends with each other, then we become friends with people that are different. Like, if we don't become friends with people who are different than us, then we become friends only with people who are the same as us. And then that list of all those things, it's the same way, right?
Yeah.
It's like,
the only
man,
people that hurt me
are white people.
Are white people, yeah.
So wait a minute. So we can break that down both ways. I thought you and I had a conversation in the hallway one time that I was fascinated with because you allowed me to be completely honest with you about a question I had about the African-American community and culture. I'm driving to work one day and I had a new vehicle that had XM radio. And I grew up listening to rap. Growing on the reservation, we had
a lot of rap on the reservation.
No, the culture was very much with the guys that I hung out with, was very much rap music and that kind of stuff. But I brought this good laugh. Both of you guys are laughing at me.
It's funny to think about.
It is funny to think about because look at me. But
well, not just.
But the point I'm trying to make is I grew up listening to it at a time when all the white people were listening to rap.
Yeah.
And it was the lyrics were just, they're very wholesome. And it was, you know, I mean, hell, Marky Mark, who's white, was doing songs about don't take drugs. You know, I mean, stuff like that.
Somewhat wholesome.
I turned on XM radio and I just went over to rap and I was like, I enjoy the beat of it.
Sure.
In other words, that's my point. As I grew up listening to that, I have eclectic music tastes. I enjoy the beat. The beat was the same. The words. I was like,
different.
Holy crap.
Yeah.
It was AK-47s and disrespectful words about women and stuff. And so I asked you, why is that? And you had an incredibly compelling answer for that.
Well, my answer was this. The first thing I did was challenge you to listen to other genres and to see if you got that same message back lyric.
And I did.
All right.
Country music. Get up in my truck, in my little short Daisy Dukes, whatever it is, country I hate.
Well, the one thing that hip hop has added to it is an element of violence and the celebration of the drug culture and a lot of negativity. But the point that I was making to you is, in order for something to get on Sirius XM or in order for something to be on your shelves at Walmart, do you know how many lawyers and do you know how many people between the lines have to sign off on this message before it hits the airwaves?
Right.
You can't just wake up in your bedroom and all of a sudden it's available to the public. Somebody has to check off on this. Somebody has to sign off on these messages.
But you were saying that the message in other types of music is not as serious as it is in urban music. And you were saying that I was getting it wrong. You were saying that it was there's something behind that.
There was more of a message there than it was just violence. Yes. There was actually something that was being taught.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. I had it backwards.
It's two parts to it.
Right.
There's a side of hip hop, which is a reflection of the culture. But there's another part of it that's a perpetuation of the culture. Now, the perpetuation of that culture is controlled by those lawyers and the people that I said are signing off on this, the big heads and the moguls in entertainment. So what I was saying to you is the reason that you're hearing what you're hearing from the hip hop community is because behind the scenes, somebody's agenda only wants you to hear that side.
Right.
That's not the only side of hip hop. That's not the only type of music that's being made. So what it was kind of steering back into is the hidden cloak of institutional racism.
Yes.
And the stereotypes that are trying to be projected. So if you only put out this type of image, you only put out this type of music over and over and over and over again to the masses, not only are people like yourselves going to develop an opinion, but people themselves are going to be subconsciously programmed to even take on that role.
Case in point, if I don't have a friend that I'm comfortable approaching with a question, ignorant white guy driving along in the road, holy crap! And then it forms an erroneous stereotype of an entire group of people if you don't ask the question and burrow into this. Because I had no idea what you were saying. What you said about the industry, I didn't know that. So now I know it's not a reflection of the broad culture.
No.
It's a reflection of somebody who's monetizing a specific thought process about a culture.
Which I think would be fair to say in all music. I mean, look, these record companies aren't selling music that's not being bought and not being consumed on some level. So, and it goes back to a conversation you and I were having earlier with a guest. It all comes back to money. But the problem is that what is the message that money is selling?
Yeah. Well, I want to explore, because coming from my point of view, I tend to reject sometimes words like phrases like institutional racism, white privilege.
White privilege, yeah.
Those are terms that I think in the media get used to divide us, and to make me run over here to my side and you run over there to your side. And yet when you explained it the way you did, I got to admit I had been wrong about what I was thinking. So what is institutional racism to you?
To me, institutional racism is a direct practice of holding down a people, whether it be politically, whether it be economically, or whether it be socially. Or it's a tool of propaganda in order to form opinions on people of color that might not necessarily be true.
Hence what I saw tuning in XM radio.
Correct.
Hearing specific songs designed for both me and you to hear, but correct, to have completely different points of view about.
Yes.
Where do you think that comes from?
I think it comes.
Is it race based or is it money based?
Well, the only reason I would say it's race based is because I don't think the negative content is the only way to make money.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that.
And I think we're all attracted. What makes rap music attractive, especially, is that we're all enamored with two things: the rhythm and the cadence. Those are the two things that we love about rap music. Yeah. And as a music producer and being a disc jockey, I know that those are the two elements that we all fall in love with.
Right. I fall in love with it because I have none of either. But I like hearing people that do.
Yeah.
So in other words, it's like you got this neat, beautiful package right here, and all you got to do is say, insert message here.
Right.
Now, you can insert any message in the world inside of this addictive rhythm and cadence. Why is only the negative perpetuated? And that's the only question that really ponders me. Why is that the drug culture, the less than 1% of our population, pushed to the forefront and represented through the worlds of entertainment and media?
Who's behind that?
It's got to be the check writers. It's got to be the people at the top of
it. But see, that to me, we're back at money.
Right.
I mean, is there a group of people in the music industry that are truly racist, or is it just that they see profit signs from keeping us divided? Because I think that's what's happening in the media. I think the media elements of it are profiting off of us all being mad at each other mm-hmm. and not looking beyond just this facade.
Well, the thing about it is that this all started in 1969 with the production of the first black exploitation film.
Okay.
And I think that the same attitude has been perpetuated and carried on for 50 plus years.
For people that don't know what that is, yeah, what is that?
Explain that.
Those are movies that were the beginning to star African Americans and be predominantly casted by African Americans, but they were always portrayed as basically pimps and drug dealers for the most part.
Okay.
And they were perpetuated as heroes.
Right.
Almost like the Renaissance men, the leaders of your community.
You mentioned they were cast as leads. Who was producing? Who were making these movies? Predominantly African Americans, or was it predominantly Hollywood whites?
It had to be Hollywood. African Americans have never had the ownership or the financial power.
So there's giving of something, but not giving of complete honesty in the sense of, yeah, this is part of the culture, just like this could be part of white culture, but this is the part of your culture we're going to elevate and say, this is what this culture is like, which is what you're saying, which is when the problem started.
Correct.
Is it what would happen if a white guy says, I'm going to make a black film?
I think that's exactly what happened.
Right. I mean, it's like, I'm going to make a film about Native Americans. Let's build a bunch of teepees. I mean, how ignorant is that?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Is that what we're talking about here? And it, because if you go back even farther than that in the movie industry, blackface was okay. It wasn't, but you understand what I'm saying.
And I just read up on about the history of blackface and I saw how other people were casted in movies and how it was even offensive that Native Americans couldn't even play their own people in movies, which I thought was offensive. The thing that's interesting about black exploitation movies is that it made criminals heroes.
Yeah.
And what it did is it perpetuated a criminal culture which has thrived for 50 plus years that they've capitalized on.
And still going on.
So the rap music that you're hearing now, you got to think this initiative started back in 1969, right about the same time as, you know, public housing, a lot of those other initiatives started booming. Mm,
right.
That's why I can kind of wrap that all into the same.
So the guy who got hailed as a hero in the African-American community was the pimp and the drug dealer and all of this.
Correct.
And it got aggrandized by Hollywood.
Correct. And we all know the power of media.
Right.
You know, what you see on TV, what you hear in your ears, you know, we tend to put that on a different pedestal and we begin to accept those things.
So I think a lot of white people probably don't understand any of that.
I never even thought of what you said, 79?
69.
69.
Right after the civil rights movement.
Right. And I'd never even considered that before. And yet it's still going on today. I think there are people, and maybe I'm completely ignorant in saying this. Maybe this is my white boy saying this, but I think there are guys like Will Smith that the rap culture has tried to change that, and others to him. But most of it is okay. Let me ask this: is it fair to say that most, because you asked Leland to really listen to other parts of rap and figure out, is it all like that, or is it most like that, or is that actually the smallest part that you just happen to listen? Where would you put it? How would you break it down as far as what they're exalting? The percentage of what they're exalting that's good or what they're exalting that isn't good?
Well, it kind of all started in the early 90s. There was a shift, and that's when so-called gangster rap really hit the scene and took over the scene. Before that, you know, there were songs like Self-Destruction and groups like X-Clan and other people. It was really either more of a party vibe or even more of an educational black upliftment vibe. You know, there was a time where hip-hop was helping people to explore their identity, even tracing back into African roots and things of that nature.
Right.
I didn't agree with all of it, but I did like the fact that it had a positive tone.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere down the line, and remember, this is before social media.
Mm-hmm.
This is before the internet. Okay? So you can only hear music through your radio or through records that got physically mass produced,
right,
which we don't know how much money cost. Or to get a music video on either MTV or BET. So what I was saying is about the message being controlled is, even if this positive content was out there, at some point the people at the top decided this is the direction that we're going to go in. Mm. These are the images you're going to see. This is the music that you're going to hear. And hip hop was not always that way.
So what do you think is the equivalent of that amongst white America, the equivalent of what you're talking about? Is there one? Is there no equivalence here? Like, I mean, trying to get to the question. It's I feel like this is something that has been, whether on purpose or not, has been used to intentionally divide us.
Correct.
And I feel like, you know, growing up in a culture that was different from my own, I've watched a lot of ignorance in my life. And I've seen a lot of people mistreat my friends who are Native Americans based on the color of their skin and no other reason. I know that racism is out there. I reject politically the notion that, like, when I hear institutional racism, what I hear is that we have government institutions that are, you know, involved in it. But I think what you're saying, this is why I was enlightened by our conversation, because you see it as something totally different.
Correct.
And I'm like, holy crap. I mean, if it's the government, I can petition to change that. If right. if it's this sort of cabal of profiteers, I don't know how to fix that.
Or is it just a mass of ignorant people?
I think it's both, don't you?
I think it's a combination of both. But I wouldn't use the term ignorant because it's deliberate. So people actually okay. know what they're doing.
Okay.
Right.
Because I sit there and I think about...
That's a good point, yeah.
I sit there and think about the racism that I know. Okay, and I'll give you a perfect example of the story that I use all the time. When Tubby Smith was head coach at UK, I would defend him vehemently because I felt like a lot of the criticism that he got while he was still coach here was race-based. Now, all of it, no. There was certainly some legitimate. But I probably thought there was more than maybe there was based on one conversation I had with a lady at my grandfather's visitation in southeastern Kentucky. And I hate saying southeastern Kentucky because that's even got a stigma of it as being more racially based or more racist than other parts of Kentucky. And I don't know that that's true because, you know, if you talk to African Americans who live in Harlan, Kentucky, they live seemingly at peace with, you know, with a larger number of white people. At least that's the way it appears to me. But this one lady at my grandfather's visitation, Coach Smith was just, I don't know, it was his third or fourth year. He'd won his national championship, but he was now, you know, starting to, they weren't playing Patino ball, right? And they wanted Patino ball. They wanted that fast pace. And this lady came up and they'd lost a few games that year. And she went by the casket and she came up to me and she said, I'll tell you the problem. And I'm like, I don't even know what is she talking about. We there's no context here at all. She said, I'll tell you the problem. We need a white general. And I about smacked a woman at my granddad's visitation. And I sat there and thought, because what was my ignorance is we don't live in a racist society anymore. That was what I thought. And then I had that conversation. I thought, oh no, it's still here. But that and what goes on down there is more to me, and tell me if you think I'm wrong about this, that's more ignorance and more what was taught to them.
Correct.
Than it is actual hate.
I think so. I could say that. I would agree with that. And it also falls into the line of, you know, look at Alabama's football team.
Yeah.
And then yeah. Or look at Texas and other places. And so you have people, right, that would even declare themselves racist.
Yeah.
That would cheer for their favorite teams.
Right.
And they have black athletes.
Let me tell you something. I'll tell you a story. Starkville, Mississippi. I went to Starkville, Mississippi. And limit, there is no more aptly named place in this country than Starkville, Mississippi, because there's nothing there. And I heard some of the foulest, most racial slurs hurled at my teammates who were predominantly black while their team was predominantly black while we were warming up. And I thought, how can you be yelling? I get it. We're right. You know, y'all want to beat us, so you're going to yell nasty things at us. But how can they be race-based when your team has as many African Americans as my team does? And I sit there thinking, this is illogical what's going on here.
Well, it goes back to the mindset of people still looking at people as three-fifths of a man. You're not even human. You're a racehorse. You're a gladiator. You are not a human being. Matter of fact,
you're an entertainer.
You're here to serve me.
Yeah, that's right.
You're on my plantation right now. And that's the mindset. And I always try to understand how people could live in that space or think that way. I think that's the only way they could look at it.
I'd never even thought of that. And you're exactly right, because that's how it was. It was, they're black too, but those are our blacks. Those are our blacks.
Right.
So, wow. You know, we don't hate them as much as we hate your blacks. Oh, man.
Wow. Until they lose.
come on, man. We didn't. Who's they? We didn't lose much in the 90s.
They sure didn't.
Go ahead.
Do you have any sort, when you walk around Louisville, when you walk around Kentucky, Do you have any moments where you genuinely feel like you experience in a moment racism from somebody? And if so, how often do you think that happens? Or how much of that, because this is a question I had a direct message conversation with a friend of mine I went to high school with, where we were talking about how, Leland, you brought up how racism is thrown out there today. If you disagree, if I disagree with you, you're racist. If racial lines enter into the political conversation one iota, if you disagree, well, then you're just racist or you're a Nazi or something like that. And it's used as kind of a way to shut people down, right? Because nobody wants to be labeled that. So, all right, well, if I'm going to be called this, I'm backing out of the conversation. But so I told him, he said, how much of that do you think people actually feel like, do they really feel like they're racist, or are they using that as some sort of club, so to speak, or a, you know, to say, okay, be done with this conversation or I'm just going to label you racist. So how much of that individually do you think you experience as being a black man in Kentucky?
It really comes up when we talk about the issue of African-Americans in the police, and especially when we talk about the innocent, because there are cases of this, right? We can point innocent, unarmed black people that were killed by police.
Right.
Now, where I feel the racial tone, and it comes in a very subtle way, is that as soon as you start to have this conversation, someone immediately points to, what about the black-on-black crime?
Right.
And to me, that's a deflection.
Right. That's not the
point.
That's
a diversion from the issue.
That's right. There's something else.
So the things that we face, they're a lot more subtle than they used to be.
Yeah.
But anytime I feel like somebody's deflecting,
yeah,
I feel like they're running away from the issue. And those are the conversations I've seen to take the most
instead form in. And Leland, this is something we were talking about earlier, instead of engaging in this conversation and saying, okay, let me learn, this is different from what I believe, and that brings up fear in my mind. Wait a minute. Let me learn from someone who's experienced it and see how real this actually is for them, and then have some understanding.
Yeah,
which, if nothing else, brings us together.
Well, and another issue that and I try to educate people on, and I got some wrestling back and forth. This is on the issue of voting. You know, when you take people back through the history of African Americans from the beginning to a country all the way up until right now, you know, I've talked to politicians and I've talked to certain people that are like, I don't understand why people just don't get out and vote. I don't understand why your people don't do this or don't do that. And what I try to explain to you, if you look at the historical context of what my people have been through, I think it's your job to persuade us to be a part of the political process, not to demonize us for not being part of the process. Because what do we have to gain? What have we won? At what year, at what politician was in this seat or that seat that our lives would change for the better? And when you ask most black people that,
yeah,
in general, there's no real solid answer.
Well, then let's go to Obama. What did that mean for African America in this country?
Well, the thing that was disappointing about President Obama's presidency is that it was great symbolically,
yes,
but it did nothing. It did nothing economically, and it did nothing to advance people of color. Mm. I think when Obama got in office, that he used the base and he used us to corral and get those votes.
Yeah.
And then I think that he put his attention and focus on advancing different demographics.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be very careful about how I say that, but I think you guys know where I'm going.
Yeah.
Do you think, well, how did you feel, though, that night that he was first elected?
Mm.
I was happy. It was a sense of pride. And you just want to know that it's possible.
Right.
And that's what it's all about. You just want to know it's possible. You just want to know that it's okay to dream. You know, it's okay to shoot for the stars. And that, yes, despite, I can. And I think that's the message that you walked away with that night. Despite, I can. It doesn't matter what it is.
Despite what?
Anything. Despite any type of, how can I word this? Despite any type of
Don't worry about how you word it. It's all good. That's just the whole point of the conversation.
Despite anything that you're going through, despite if the odds are against you or not, it's possible.
Right.
You know, even looking at the history of this country.
Despite the adversity.
Correct.
Whatever
it is. Do you think that, I'm really fascinated by the concept that you touched on, that, because again, you're blowing away misconceptions that I had in my mind. Most of the time, if I heard somebody say, you need to persuade me to vote, I'd be like, no, it's your right. Go do it.
Right.
But when you said persuade me, because what have we got? Something about that rang really true. And I was like, I never thought about it that way. You're looking at, there are still people alive I can't think of this because it wasn't when I was growing up. You know, I don't know anything, but here we are as friends. But when my parents were young, you couldn't drink out of the same water fountain as I could.
Yeah, correct.
Those people are still alive.
Yeah.
They still saw that. So I kind of get what you're saying when you say, convince us. Mm. So how do we do that?
I'll say this. And if you heard me say this numerous times, I think that the change actually has to come from the political right. And here's why.
I agree with this. I know where you're going.
The left, if we look at Truman, if we look at LBJ, and we look at Kennedy, all of them has been deemed as almost like civil rights heroes, right? All these people were backed in the corner and used people of color in order to survive politically. Their hearts were not for the advancement of people of color. They were all backed into a corner, each and every one of them.
So basically saying to get elected,
correct,
this is the demographic we got to go after.
Kennedy definitely needed us. His whole deal with Martin Luther King Jr. And helping him get out of jail and all those things, that was a political play. Mm. We all know about the phone call that LBJ made down there to Texas, talk about there's too many N-words voting down there. And this literacy test thing isn't working to stop them. Mm. So,
hold on. Can we just remind people that that happened?
Yeah,
it did happen.
I wonder. let me stop you. I've seen those memes about LBJ saying, I will have these voting Democrat for 50 some odd, 60 some odd years. And I have struggled to believe that's true because of how, use your word, Leland, divisive that is. And it is. I mean, that's basically what his attitude was, is that we need this for power. That's all we care about is the power. In that sense, I'm not saying that's how it is today, and I'm not blaming Democrats today. I'm just saying, but in that sense, that's how it was.
Well, and me as an African-American, and I'm a slab back in the way I said a change has to come from the right.
Yeah.
If you're a person of color and you look at how things are going, and you even look at the issues that's going on right now, right? Oh, it's the border, and it's separating families, and it's this, and it's that, right. And you know, when it's Trump, and I mean, they'll rally the troops, and they'll march, and they'll get on CNN and MSNBC, and they'll get loud and all those things, but nobody's talking about the water crisis in Flint, Michigan, and Detroit with the lead. Even with Native Americans, the Dakota Pipeline and other issues have kind of slid away. Nobody's talking about the public education crisis where the average teacher is spending $300 to $500 of their own money to make sure that the classrooms have enough supplies. Mm. So as a person of color, I feel like not only are we being used every 2 or 4 years when you need our votes, but we've almost been swapped out since they decided, since they don't want to come out and vote anymore, let's put all of our focus on the Latino vote, which I think is even more racist, because while they try to play the card of we're the country of, you know, letting in immigrants and opening our doors and opening our borders and do this and that, all they're doing is securing their future voting base in order to stay in power. So I don't want to feel politically used anymore. And what I have to say is this: if the right can devise a real political and economic message to give people of color more ownerships of the businesses in their communities and more financial opportunities, like the same opportunities that immigrants get when they come over here and get $25,000, $50,000 to start, 5-10 years without taxes. You know, if the right could actually put people of color in a position to succeed, the Democratic Party could get wiped out.
You got one?
Well, I was just going to say, I'm fascinated by this part
of
the conversation.
I got to use the bathroom and I'm going to come back because I know I'm just going to go for a whip.
All right. Picking up where you are right there with this. Can I continue?
Yeah.
Or you want me to wait?
No, go.
Okay. So picking up with where we are with this, the right, you say the right needs to devise a solution. Do you think the right is... Do you think that when we constantly use that, like throw around, you're a racist, you disagree with me or whatever, do you think the right is afraid to approach the African-American community?
I think so in this climate because of the nationalist base that's been energized.
Right.
I don't think that they want to lose those numbers. And I think that they're afraid to say anything that would offend those people or turn those people off.
Right.
But I do think that there's a happy medium in there somewhere if they really wanted to put that to the side.
Yeah. Do you think that there's an element of the right that would reject the right if they made an overture to the African-American community?
I think so.
So are there... It feels like we're dealing with two different kinds of racism. We're dealing with political racism, which is what you said when you're used as a pawn.
Correct.
And then we're dealing with the racism of hatred, where you have people that legitimately say, you're different than me, I don't understand you, so I hate you. I mean, it feels like that's what we're dealing with. Essentially, racism breaks down along two lines, political and hatred.
Correct. I just think that, And I know you'll finish your question. The reason that I could deal with more blatant racism than I can with cunning racism.
Because of where it's coming from.
Yeah, and I'd rather not be used.
Right.
You know?
Well, if you hate me because we're different, then you're just ignorant and I don't really want to spend any time on you anyway. But if you hate me because of a political reason, or if you're using me because of political, I totally see your point. That's far more sinister.
I think so.
Because that's controlling.
Yeah.
Like somebody that, if you see somebody walking around in a pointy hat, you just stay away from
it
them.
It is what it is.
It is what it is. And at least they bared their ignorance in front of everybody.
Probably not going to be a high level intellectual conversation going exactly. on at that point anyway.
Exactly. I mean,
it's probably, the lines have been drawn at that point.
But if somebody gives you a political flyer, says, I need you to vote for me because I got this for you.
Yeah.
That's far more sinister. I mean, not that any of it is acceptable.
But you know what?
But
I was going to say, but bottom line is that goes, that's just not something that I think happens to the black community. I think that's what politics has kind of become for us
today. Well, it's a politics of demographics.
Yeah, it's you need to vote for me because this is what I'm going to do for you.
Working white voters and Hispanic community.
Yeah, as opposed to, well, what's best for the country, all of us at the same time. Let me ask you this. What is it, I'm trying to word this the way I want to because it's such a large question. But what is it you as how old are you?
I'm 38.
38-year-old African-American. What is it you're most proud of in this country, with this country? And what are you most ashamed of with this country? And we probably talked about a lot of the shame, but I don't want to put words in your mouth. So what would your answer to those questions be?
I would say the thing I'm most proud of this country is opportunity. Because despite... If you really want something in this country, there's a path to get there. That's one thing I will say about America. It may not be a comfortable path.
Right.
It may not be an even path. It may not be fair. But there is a path to get there.
It may not be the same path for all of us. And that may be where we get into the white privilege and that kind of thing. But there is a path.
Correct.
Okay.
And that's what I'm most proud of. Most disappointing.
Yeah.
Is how we parade ourselves as a country of morals and how, you know, to quote, you know, my friend, Dr. Ricky Jones, we are a country that had moments of peace, but we're not a peaceful country.
Mm-hmm.
This country was built off violence all around the board. It was built off violence and it was built off the back of migrant workers. But we parade ourselves as a country of peace and morals. We did not enter World War II because of Hitler and his nationalist views, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
We entered World War II, why?
Because they attacked us.
Who attacked us?
Japanese. Not exactly. Even Germans.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And in World War
One, actually,
World War One, we didn't enter until they attacked us in that.
I'll tell you the funny thing, too, and this is kind of off subject, but if you go back and look, and Leland, you and I were talking about just how much I'm learning about World War II, Churchill, the things he did underhanded to involve himself. You know, we're complaining about the Russians being so involved in our play. What Churchill did to involve himself in our voting system to try to get us to become, you know, actually real allies for him early in World War II, it was pretty sinister. I mean, he may have been our ally at some point, but he was digging deep to try to sway votes to get more, to get rid of the isolationists and say, no, y'all got to come over and help us fight this.
Yeah.
And another thing that's disappointing is not to stray too far along the line, but when we talk about terrorism and we point the fingers at this and that, one thing that our country is absolutely buried alongside of Nagasaki, Hiroshima, is the firebombing on Tokyo.
Yeah.
Which was horrible.
Yeah.
You know.
And
well, we've also buried the concentration camps we put
not just
Asian
that,
Americans
but
in.
But there was firebombing in Germany, too.
Yeah. So our country has a history of attacking citizens.
Yeah.
You know, so I just don't like us parading around as this this country that we got such this moral outstanding background and we're such a peaceful, loving people.
Do you believe in American exceptionalism? I mean, because those are hard statements, true statements, I think. But do you believe, I mean, do you believe there's another place on this world that you would rather live? If you take the opportunity and our failure, is there another place? Or do you think, you know what, I could not be more blessed to be here?
Based on the knowledge that I have right now, yeah. I wouldn't want to live anywhere else in the world.
Okay.
Based on what I know right now.
Yeah, I think.
Now, if I was to explore the world and see other places and be explored at the different things.
Yeah.
But
I just wonder, because, again, I grew up, again, different culture, middle class, white bread world, white mom and dad, white culture. And I am an American exceptionalist. I do believe, you know, I don't believe we're the best because we act like we're the best. I definitely believe we've got our faults, but I wouldn't want to live anywhere else. And I've traveled and seen other places. I still believe that. And I just wonder from your point of view, if it's the same thing.
Well, there's nothing better than capitalism. I believe the ability to choose what you want to do for a living and how much money you're going to make. And it's all on you.
Yeah.
I wouldn't trade that for anything. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't want to live in a communist or a socialist country.
What is, I was just thinking about what you said too. My wife and I have been touring, famous Native American sites. And I consider myself patriotic. I love my country. I appreciate the men and women who've died for it and are serving it right now. I do think we're the greatest country in the world, but I think there's a lot of truth in what you said, that it's important for us to see the history. One of the most moving moments that I had was we went to the Battle of Bighorn, Little Bighorn in Montana, and it was where Custer's last stand was. And we were driving first through the park, and there were headstones on either side where the fallen of both sides, Native Americans and American troops. There was an American flag on every stone, both sides, both sides. It brought me to tears because I realized that that battle was a symbol of one of the most atrocious elements of our history.
Right.
And that was entirely based on ignorance. A lot of the men, and I've got a point where I'm getting to here, but I want to ask about, because I want your thoughts on this.
I got a thousand questions already.
A lot of the people who were fighting the Indian Wars were coming from the East Coast, where they had been told by the media about these savages that were ripping the heads and, you know, skulls scalping, off of people. Those savages were actually just men and women defending their home.
Their home.
But the people on the East Coast didn't know this. And this is why I'm coming to the term of context. We have to see what we did wrong, because we have to understand the context of the times. Many of those men in the cavalry unit were patriots who thought they were doing the right thing. But on the other side, they were just defending their homeland. Is there an element in our debate today, 12, where we've lost the context? You know, we talk about statues from the Civil War and all this stuff. I don't want to glorify that, but at the same time, if we lose the context of understanding, because like I think back to the Founding Fathers.
Yeah.
The Founding Fathers were imperfect men framing an idea that could help evolve into something far more perfect. The context of those times was these were people coming out of the Enlightenment, literally out of the Dark Ages. We couldn't expect them to go from that to completely
where we are today.
Right.
Yeah.
Is there an element of our arguments and our debates today? I'm sorry to do such a long question, but that is based on a lack of context. And do we lose that context at our peril in understanding what, going with what you said, we haven't always been a moral nation.
Nor will we ever be a moral nation.
Because our morals shouldn't come from government.
Right.
But
well, and even if it doesn't, if you're talking about morals coming from God, we're never going to be perfect. We're never going to be a perfect nation because we are imperfect people.
Right. But is there an element of that context that's being lost by the hyperventilating on both sides of our current tensions?
It's two parts of that. The first part of that, because there is a new tension here, but the first part of that, and whether it be about talking about things historically or going back to the point where I was, you know, making the talking about black people being killed by the police and people saying, what about black on black crime? Right. Is that for the most part, America has a problem with saying, you know what? My fault. I was wrong. Yep. Honestly.
Yes. We
immediately look to justify our actions.
Yeah, that's absolutely
immediately.
Right.
So the biggest problem we have is saying, you know what? My fault. I was wrong. You know what? That officer did murder that person.
Yeah.
They should be going to jail instead of saying, well, you know, back in 10 years ago, this guy caught with a bag of weed in his pocket. I mean, for real, like we always right. look for the smallest reasons to justify the worst behaviors.
Right.
And nobody ever takes on accountability.
That's good. I'm writing that now.
I think
paper. That's good.
You said there were two things.
And today's climate, I think today's climate is more dangerous than ever. And the reason today's climate is more dangerous than ever is because both sides of the media are fueling what I see is a future physical, political, civil war.
Yeah.
And it's dangerous.
Scares me.
Yeah, me too.
It's very dangerous.
Yeah.
And
they don't make, and I don't mean to interrupt 12, but they don't make their money unless people are angry. They don't get their clicks unless people are angry, unless they're fired up, unless they're moved with passion. And it's not a positive passion that they're being moved with. And that's what worries me.
Yeah, and that's one of the problems that I have with the left. You know, they come out with this thing that says we go low and they go high. And mind you, I'm an independent. I'm not a conservative. If a lot of people hear me talk, you would think I was a conservative. My problem is I'm not a conservative. I'm just not with the leftist idealism right now. And they are doing the worst job right now of justifying bad behavior. They are turning the entire country upside down just because they don't like somebody. That's dangerous.
Yeah.
They are arming people out here to put their hands on and physically fight people who are in political power, who are in opposition to their party. What happens when that just turns into everyday Americans?
Right.
Not agreeing. If you see a Republican on the street, or if you see somebody with a MAGA hat on the street, how far away are we from that moment?
Right.
We are not that far away.
And
from
there are countries that live like that now. Correct. That's not an impossibility.
And they're fueling it. It's being fueled. Yeah. And that's why I think today is more dangerous more than ever, because now it's going outside of racial lines.
Yeah.
Now it's becoming political.
Political lines.
Violently political.
Another issue that I think is a term that I hear that sometimes is used to divide us, but maybe I don't fully understand it, is the idea of white privilege. I think everybody has a certain amount of privilege if you're an American. It may come from various different quarters. You know, I was raised in a home that was poor by choice. My parents chose to be missionaries, so they didn't have money to send me to college, paid my own way. I had no leg up in society. So when I have people tell me that, well, you're white and therefore you're way ahead of me, I have a tendency to reject that. I would just say that we have different paths. There's different obstacles in front of you, and I'm not justifying those. But there's different obstacles in front of me, if that makes sense. Help me understand that term.
Let's go back to 1934 with the Federal Housing Act, when the United States government actually started practicing redlining.
Talking about red line districts, yeah.
Correct. Now, this is a national practice. This is not philosophy. Yeah. This is our country.
It was heavy here in
Louisville. Who actually decided that if you were this color and you lived in these neighborhoods, you would not be approved of these housing loans. And if you lived outside of these neighborhoods and you were this demographic, 98% actually were given these housing loans. It was America's idea to segregate us. So now, what year is it right now?
2018.
People are still feeling the effects of redlining. Mm-hmm. We are just now entering the next phase, which is gentrification. All right. Gentrification. Now, these same neighborhoods that people were built in and divided in and being confined in are now being overpriced to make those people move out so other people can move in. Mm-hmm. It's a continuation of the culture. So when people say white privilege, it's not necessarily that, oh, because you're white, then congratulations, you get a pass. It's that if you look at things historically, the deck was stacked
right
against people of color.
Yeah,
and that's the truth.
And I don't disagree with that. But I would ask, because these are hard questions now.
Yeah.
I would ask, what responsibility do you think I have as an individual who's never stood in anybody's way? What can I do to fix that? What responsibility do I have? Because what I hear on college campuses is you need to subjugate yourself.
Right.
As a white male, especially.
Right.
Males are very much under attack. You need to subjugate yourself. You need to hate yourself. blame yourself. You despise the fact that you were born and apologize for your existence. That's the extreme of it on college campuses.
That's really extreme.
I know. Yeah. But that forces, that doesn't force, that causes people to have a knee-jerk reaction to the term white privilege.
Right. Where, and again, going back to, not to finish your sentence, Leland, but it just as a thought, where we want to reject it outright.
Exactly.
As opposed to hear what you just had to say is, huh.
Well, without realizing, again, most people that look like you and me, Cameron, don't know about redlining.
Exactly.
We don't know it was just less than 100 years ago.
Right.
We don't know that you're still
feeling the effects. And now there's the gentrification. Now it's changing again in a different way to now move you out and replace you with someone else.
So where's the sweet spot? What is my responsibility? Because I reject the fact that I need to feel sorry for being born.
Yeah, you shouldn't do that.
But at the same time,
blame your mom and dad for that.
But at the same time, I recognize your point. And I want every American, regardless of the color of their skin, to be treated by their character. If they are capable of carrying the mortgage, carry the mortgage in whatever neighborhood they want to be in. How do we fix this?
Well, it begins by what this show today is based on. And it's about you and Cameron as white males asking me as an African-American male questions that you always want to know the answers to. And instead of just forming your own opinions, you really want to know. It starts with that honest conversation. I don't think you should wake up every day and demonizing yourself. That is a very extreme way to look at life. I do not think that is an effective measure. But once you ask those questions and you get those answers, you begin to understand other people's struggle. And what it does for you is it takes away the finger pointing. Mm. Well, if I did it, you should be able to do it.
Yeah.
Oh, now I understand why it didn't work that way for you, man. So it's important to be historically educated.
Yeah, I agree.
On how things have gone. It's important to have conversations with people outside of your race so you can understand their challenges and their struggles.
Which is part of the education anyway, and the historical education as well. I don't know how much more time we've got, Leland, but I want to ask this. As far as you personally, 12, what are you going to do? I mean, you already do so much. And we started this conversation talking about how you make a difference, and that is your heart. But where do you see yourself? I'm going to ask a question. I hate it when I get asked. In 5 years, politics, are you making a difference here? I mean, I look at people say, Cameron, are you ever going to get in politics? No, because I feel like I'm making a bigger difference in ministry than I could anywhere else where I'm just teaching Christ. Then I'll make a bigger difference there than I will on radio, than I will on the Disruption Zone, than I will anywhere else. What about you? Where is your biggest difference made in your community, in Louisville, in Kentucky, in this country, in this world?
I thought about making a run for mayor after Fisher, honestly. Politically, and I really want to enter into the realm of political radio and political television. One, I do not think that African Americans are always portrayed in the right light when it comes to television and media. We're always portrayed as angry.
Yeah.
We're always yelling. We're always screaming. We're always fighting, and we've picked a side. We know when I watch Don Lemon, when I watch Van Jones, and when I watch other people. Their minds are completely made up before those debates start. And I don't think that's fair. I don't think that puts black people in the light to where we're thinking and we're sifting through things politically.
I mentioned to Leland earlier, and he knows this. It's the third time I've mentioned this on the show, but I'm going to mention it again because to me it was one of the most intelligent things mentioned, and that's by our Secretary of Defense, James Mattis, who said when you enter into a conversation with someone who is your, he said enemy, but he was thinking of it in terms of, ISIS. He's thinking of it, is be willing to be persuaded. In other words, be willing to hear. And I think that's what you're saying is we go in, some of these people are going into conversations, mind made up. I don't care what you have to say. These are my talking points. I'm sticking to them. I'm going to make my point. You're going to make your point. We're going to walk away and no minds are going to be changed. And therefore, no difference is going to be made.
I go into a discussion with two things. I go into discussion to share my views and opinions because it took all 38 years of my life and experience to come to this place that I'm at today.
Right.
And like you said, I come to be persuaded. I want to know what the other side is thinking. Mm. Why do you believe this policy is better? Why do you believe that? I'm not here to fight.
Mm-hmm.
I'm here to understand because somewhere in between has got to be the truth and the best solution for everybody.
It's very powerful. I don't think you can top that.
No. There's a lot in here we can't top.
Yeah. Dude, to know him is to love him.
Absolutely. I agree.
It was funny. You were talking about angry. I was like, I've never seen you angry in my life.
You know, like, why, though? Because you know. You know what I mean? I mean, because I think a lot of times when I'm in a debate and I'm angry, it's because I feel weak, because I feel ignorant of the topic. And I think you have done so much research and education. Like you said, you're 38 years and you've thought a lot. And so there's no reason to go into a conversation angry. Let's go in a conversation and talk.
Right.
And here's another thing that gives me so much peace. And this is why, even in the face of the most violent or foul conversations, yeah, I can be cool. And it is a spiritual thing.
Yeah.
The last thing that Christ said was, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Mm. If people really, really, really knew, they think that they know.
Right.
But if they really knew, they wouldn't act the way they act. Yep. They wouldn't say what they say.
Yep.
They wouldn't go about things the way they go about things.
Yep.
So there's a certain semblance of ignorance that people are living in to act and carry themselves in a certain way. And I forgive them for that.
All right. I'm not topping that.
Nope. Can't. 12, Mr. FTC. Dude, it's good to talk to you.
You too, man.
Love you, buddy.
Thank you,
brother. You too.
All right. This is Disruption Zone. Go.